Al Cohn has recorded many albums under his own name. For most of the 70s, he recorded on the Xanadu label. He's now with Concord Jazz. His most recent album on Concord is called Nonpareil. We'll be hearing a selection from it in a moment. It was nominated for a Grammy Award. On the album Tour de Force, which is brand new, he's joined by tenor players Scott Hamilton and Buddy Tate. Cohn is also an arranger with a wide range of experience. He's arranged for singers like Sarah Vaughan and Tony Bennett. He's arranged for many TV shows, ranging from the Hit Parade to the Daytime Emmy Awards and a number of TV musical specials. He's also arranged for Broadway shows. Most recently, he did the score for the Duke Ellington musical Sophisticated Ladies. Tonight through Sunday, he'll be playing at the Flight Deck, the jazz club on Market Street in Wilmington, Delaware. For any more information about those upcoming performances, you can call the Flight Deck at area code 302-658-2301. Again, area code 302-658-2301. Well, before we meet Al Cohn, why not hear a selection from his latest album, Nonpareil? This is the album that's been nominated for a Grammy. We'll hear a piece of his own called Take Four, and playing with him is Lou Levy piano, Monty Budwig bass, and Jake Hanna on drums.
Thank you.
Tenor saxophonist Al Cohn from his latest album, Nonpareil, which was nominated for a Grammy Award. That was Take 4. Al Cohn is my guest. He's playing at the Flight Deck in Wilmington through the weekend. Al Cohn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Pleasure to be here.
You've been playing jazz for about 39 years, professionally.
Yes, next year will be my 40th year.
So you've seen jazz take leaps and falls in popularity, both in the recording business and in clubs as well. Does it bother you that there are times when lots of people turn out to hear jazz and times when jazz seems to be pushed out of the market by other forms of music? Or do you just accept that that's the way it goes?
Well, it's always nice to have people there when you're playing. it sort of gives you a little more motivation. But jazz is definitely the kind of thing that goes and comes in cycles, and after a while you expect it. Right now we're on an up period, I think.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, well, because the attendance in clubs is much improved from what it used to be in the late 60s and early 70s. And also a lot of young people seem to show an interest in it, and colleges.
Does it make any sense how these things start or taper off, these cycles of popularity?
Oh, there's probably deep reasons for it. I don't know what they are.
Let's talk about the period when you started playing and when you were playing with the big bands. Did you usually, like, tour on a bus, do the whole bit of all traveling together around the country?
Oh, yeah.
Was it invigorating or exhausting to live like that?
Well, at my age at that time, I started when I was 17 years old. It was very invigorating. Just to get away from home was invigorating. And physically, you can take a lot more when you're that age. So it was kind of rigorous, but I didn't even notice that part of it.
Is there ever an initiation period in big bands where everybody else tests you out and see what kind of person and musician you are?
I never felt that.
You didn't?
No.
How was it figured out who'd get the best situated solos in a piece?
I would say it's generally up to the either the leader or the arranger. They exercise their preferences.
Who were your favorite arrangers with the bands that you worked with?
Well, with the bands that I worked with, well, Ralph Burns and Johnny Mandel, Neil Hefti, Bud Johnson. I didn't come into contact with Quincy Jones in those days, or I never played Duke's arrangements. They're among my favorites. And let's see. A Tiny Con.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't really know how the term the Four Brothers came to be, how the saxophonist...
Well, the Four Brothers was just the name of the tune. And it came out, we became known as that, but it was just the name of the tune that Jimmy Giuffre wrote.
Did that help you all get better known, having an official name that you were...
I think given? So. I think it was pretty popular, and it still is. It's sort of a nostalgic type of thing today, but it is a really nice piece of music, and I don't think of it so much as nostalgia. I think it was something that I really enjoyed playing, and I still do enjoy listening to it. And we had that Woody Herman 40th anniversary a couple of years ago, and we played it and got a real ovation, and I think it meant a lot to a lot of people. Still people ask for it. Have to explain that I can't do it by myself.
People must come up to you all the time and have your recordings of the late 40s or early 50s be an important part of the period of time when they started listening to music, because that's always a pivotal part in someone's life when their taste is really formed, you know, when they start listening to stuff.
Oh, yes, that's true.
How do you relate to it when someone wants to hear one of those records or one of those tunes from that period because it is so personally important to them?
Well, some things obviously I can't do, like Four Brothers. Well, if I can do it, I'm very happy to do it.
Is there music for you that's that you started listening to when you were, say, in your teens or early teens, in your formative years when you'd started listening, that are very personally significant for you when you hear it?
Yes, certainly. Count Basie's band, when Lester Young was part of it, and Duke's band at that time, early 40s, when Ben Webster was the tenor player, and all of Tatum in particular. I didn't get on to Louis Armstrong until later, which is kind of funny, I guess. When I first started listening to jazz, I preferred what was current, and I thought that Armstrong was kind of dated. Then I began to understand what it was all about.
What about you? But when I was growing up and Armstrong was on the Ed Sullivan Show all the time, he was doing so much showmanship kind of stuff. He'd never really play. He seemed to me, at least at the time, to be a caricature of himself, and it wasn't until I started listening to his really early recordings that I started to have any understanding of what he was musically
about.
Oh,
yes, he was definitely a giant.
When you were playing with the big bands, what kind of function did the leaders have? Did you all really like take guidance from them when they were fronting the band, or was their role more managerial?
Well, it varied. Some of the leaders, like for instance Artie Shaw, a very good musician and knew exactly what he wanted, and was willing to rehearse for hours to get exactly what he wanted. He was very meticulous, and that was one type. Then you got other types that didn't know exactly what they want, but knew what they didn't want, and depended a lot on their arrangers. But still, well, Woody, for instance, now, Woody, he can't write, and I think he'd be the first one to say that he's not a great player. But he coordinates the whole thing. And he uses the material, he picks the material that he figures suits him and suits the band. And so he plays a very important part. That's why he always has a good band.
Let's listen to something from 1949 in which you're playing with two other tenor players, Suit Sims and Stan Getz. I don't know if you remember the recording of this. We're going to be hearing a piece called Fast. Do you remember the session?
No, I don't remember it specifically. It was done the way most recordings were done at that time, pretty haphazardly. Fast. Like the title. Yeah, we'd go in the studio, and somebody would pass around some scratching, and we'd sit down and record it, and we'd do an album in 6 hours.
How did this band get together? It also features Duke Jordan at the piano, Jim Rainey guitar, Curly Russell bass, Charlie Perry drums.
Just get a phone call and be told what time and where to appear. That was about all it amounted to.
Okay, well, let's hear this recording of Fast. Thank you. Al Cohn on tenor saxophone, along with Stan Getz and Zoot Sims, and I think I neglected to mention the trombonist Earl Swope that was recorded in 1949. Al Cohn is my guest, and he lives in the Delaware Water Gap area of Pennsylvania and is in Philadelphia on his way towards the Flight Deck, where he's performing through the weekend, and that's in Wilmington, Delaware, on Market Street. And for any more information about his upcoming performances there, you can call the Flight Deck at area code 302-658-2301. And in a few minutes, we'll be hearing some more selections from his latest albums on Concord Jazz. You've done a lot of arranging for television shows, both regular series and special programs. What did you decide to get into that aspect of music?
Well, mostly for the money. It's writing for television is, especially live television, is it's really not something that you care to hear back. It's just it's a one shot, and it's, if you let it bother you, it can be less than rewarding, because they make changes all the time. Something you might have worked very hard on and really extended yourself to get something really good, that you want it to be really good, and then they just strike it out just like that because they don't like some visual effect or some performer didn't want to do that, so that type of thing or whatever reason. So after a while, you get sort of inured to the disappointments and just go straight ahead and plow right on through it. But I don't mean to say that it's a drag or anything like that. Lots of times I've had very interesting assignments on TV.
What were the more interesting ones?
Well, when you get a good piece of material to work on, good tune for a good singer, and you get good players, and sometimes you get a nice big orchestra to work with.
You never really get credits, do you, when you're arranging for TV?
That's true.
Is it just as well as far as you're concerned, or do you wish you had the credit?
I found out it doesn't seem to make much difference. Everybody's going out to the kitchen to get a beer when the credits... And the credits are rolling, and they're usually rolling pretty fast. On live television, there's not much time at the end.
When you're writing for TV, when you're arranging for TV, do you do what you'd most want to hear, or do you try to get into the head of the people who are responsible for the TV show and write what they want to hear?
Well, I was fortunate to do most of the work for TV for Elliot Lawrence, the work that I've done for TV. And Elliot always told me to just do what I do it my way, which was nice.
I think that's a phrase used that frequently,
yeah,
on television.
Yes.
Let's see, you used to arrange for the Hit Parade.
Mm-hmm. I worked with them on their last season.
Uh-huh. I used to watch that.
Oh, yeah?
part of the hook of that show is that they do the top 10 records of the week, and they had regulars who'd perform it.
Yeah.
But of course, one of the dilemmas that I always have is that at that time, a lot of the top 10 records were rock and roll records, and the regulars on the Hit Parade show were not people who...
Not exactly, no.
Rock and roll,
not,
yeah.
Snooki and Dorothy. Well, what really killed that show was going on TV. It was all right for radio to do the same tune week after week, but on TV they had to have a different plot, different scenario for each time. So then when they were doing Hound Dog, as if it had been in a 17th or 18th century drawing room with powdered wigs, it didn't go over too well.
I think I remember them doing Smoke It's in Your Eyes, which always seemed to be number one, and blowing smoke rings. And
well, that's clever.
Yeah. didn't take much to figure that out. So what kind of arrangements would you have to do? You'd have
to
figure
a show
out
like that, you'd get a script, and you'd have to do it in, according to their storyline that they had in a certain style. And that was pretty much cut and dried.
Did you ever put little musical jokes in that only you knew existed?
Yeah, you have to entertain yourself any way you can.
Do you remember any of those?
No, not really. I didn't go into much of that stuff. You couldn't, really.
So you've also done some arranging for pageants, Miss USA pageant?
Yes.
Miss Universe pageant?
And Miss Universe, yes.
What kinds of musical demands are on you as an arranger for programs like that?
To try to do the same thing over and over again in a different way. Because the shows always have a production number, with the guest star, whoever it might be. And then they have a lot of kind of, not military marches, but basically a march where the girls sort of parade around.
What's the right kind of arrangement for that type of parade?
Well, they always have a theme. You know, they're always taking place. The ones, the Miss USA are always in some city like New Orleans or a resort town. And so you have to have the theme of that. Like if we're in, and they did one from Biloxi, so they had a lot of southern music like Dixie. And then if they have it in Hawaii, then you'd have Hawaiian music. And and then the Miss Universe is some exotic place in the Far East or Central America. And just in case there was no revolution going on, they had to have something going on there, so they had that. And so you'd keep it in the style of the place.
There's times on TV when it sounds like Nelson Riddle wrote every theme that's on the air, and other times when every theme that's on the air is a disco theme. You could usually plot by television themes what's happening in popular music. Are you expected to write within the style of the day when you're doing arranging for TV?
To some extent, yes.
So how do you keep up with what's new on the radio?
Well, I'll let you in on a little secret. I would depend mostly on the musicians that were playing the show.
To tell you? Or
no,
to play it in that way?
To just write on the thing, make like disco.
You know, it's always struck me that the singers on some variety shows have been in some real predicaments. I don't think you do arranging for this, but like if a singer... It's just happened on the Ed Sullivan Show a lot also, like a rock singer would end up having to get backed by Sullivan's band and have this real crazy arrangement that made no sense for the kind of work that they were doing. I don't know if that happens much anymore, since there isn't that kind of disparity.
It's very little live television anyway. Most of it's taped.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it's in California.
So when stuff is rebroadcast, do you try to see it? If they're ever rebroadcasting things that you arranged for?
Well, no, there's very little chance of them doing a rebroadcast of Miss Universe.
Well, that's true. I'm still waiting, though, for the hit parade to come on.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Don't hold your breath.
If it's on cable, I mean, if it's on tape, I'm sure, like, some cable station or UHF
really?
Station.
Really? Do they do that?
Well, they're doing, like, hit parade-type shows on radio now. They're not the original broadcast, but they're doing, like, the top 10 of 1953 and 1948.
From records.
Yeah. There's a lot of interest in old TV shows, and they're rebroadcasting it where they can. So, it also seems that on TV there's a lot of, like, pseudo jazz. You know, sometimes someone who you have everything doesn't know anything about jazz has to do a jazzy number.
That's usually when a crime is going to be committed.
Yeah, that's right.
Everybody knows as soon as they hear...
Or sexual passion.
As soon as they hear that, they know what's coming.
How do you feel when you're listening to pseudo-jazz that somebody else has done for TV?
Well, it's pseudo, so I don't feel too much.
You've arranged for a lot of singers also, including Tony Bennett and Sarah Vaughan. Are there certain kinds of arrangements that you think work best for a singer, or do they or their producers tell you what they want for a certain album or performance?
No, they don't tell you much. I did some arranging for Ray Charles, which was really fun because he would lay everything out on tape because naturally he doesn't read. And so he'd lay down a tape for you just the way he wanted it. And all you had to do was go by his tape and just add the horns and strings. That was really fun because it takes a lot of pressure off. You don't have to... get any basic ideas about the approach to it.
Do you like strings backing up singers?
Oh, yeah.
I've always had trouble with strings. But I know that a lot of musicians and singers have always wanted to record with strings.
Well, as a writer, it's nice to have them because they don't have to breathe.
Right.
so you never have to have any dead spots.
So you can have a really long line. I guess part of my problem with it is that when I was growing up, and even now, sometimes strings are used really for like the emotion in the background. Really, it's like sentimental or overly dramatic, schmaltzy.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Well, there's a place for them, and you don't just because they're there, you don't have to use them all the time.
Mm-hmm. What'd you do for Andy Williams?
Well, I started writing for Andy Williams. Had his first television show was a summer replacement show for Pat Boone, and Ralph Burns was doing the arranging for the show. And Ralph was so busy at that time that it was a 13-week series. And Ralph, after about four series, he was giving me most of the work to do. And then he very nicely told the producers and Andy that since he wasn't doing most of it anyway, why don't they just let me do it? And so it worked out very well. Mm-hmm. And he's a really wonderful musician, Andy, and that was a very good experience.
One of your recent projects has been doing the arrangements for Sophisticated Ladies, the Duke Ellington musical. Did you work with Ellington's original charts for that?
Well, very few of them exist. They're in such bad shape. They've been sitting around in warehouses for years, and they're all falling apart and illegible. But we worked off some of the recordings, and of course a lot of it was done original orchestrations from scratch because they had to fit the routines, the stage routines, the dancing and the singers, the different keys. And after all, it is a Broadway production. It's just not a band. So that was one of the major obstacles to make it Duke's music in Duke's way as close as possible, and also to make it for a Broadway audience and a Broadway show.
So how do you change it for the Broadway audience?
Well, in that respect, I was working with people, the choreographer and the musical director.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have the routines down, and I would get a little sketch of what the routine was like and what was needed.
While we're talking about Ellington, why don't we hear you playing one of Ellington's pieces? We'll hear Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, and this is from another new album. Al Cohn has a new album called Nonpareil that came out a few months ago on Concord Jazz, but this is from a brand new album in which he's joined by two other tenor players, Buddy Tate and Scott Hamilton. However, neither of them are featured on this selection that we're going to hear, which features Al Cohn. The album is called Tour de Force, and the piece is Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me.
Thank you.
I guess tenor saxophonist Al Cohn recorded in concert from a new album called Tour de Force. We heard Dave McKenna with him at the piano. That was Bob Mays on bass and Jake Hanna on drums. The new album is called Tour de Force, and it's on Concord Jazz. Two other tenor saxophonists are featured on the album, Scott Hamilton and Buddy Tate. And we'll be hearing a selection from Al Cohn's other recent album, Nonpareil, in a few minutes. In most of the 70s, I guess, you were recording with Xanadu Records, and you're with Concord Records now. Not every musician has the chance now to really have a contract or at least a continual working relationship with a record company. I think that's hard to get nowadays. Are there a lot of advantages to having a contract or being aligned to a company?
Definitely. First of all, you need to have an album out to get into clubs, to get work.
Really?
In clubs.
Why is that?
Well, you have to have something to promote. I don't know, but it seems that way to me. And to be with a company like Concord is it's kind of a luxury because you don't feel like you're alone. You have somebody behind you, and it's good company. He does things right, Carl Jefferson, and I'm very happy to be with them. And wherever I go, there's somebody from the company, except in Philadelphia. and then we've been doing these tours for Concord Jazz Records. We did Japan last year, and also a tour in Europe. And this year, we're going to Australia and Bangkok and Singapore and New Zealand, and also Europe again. So he's organizing these tours, and I think it's been a great help to me.
When you do an album, the record that we opened with, I asked you how it got together, and you said, well, you get the phone call, you go to the session, that was made in about 1949. When you're doing an album under your name, what kind of organization do you like to have to it, and how much planning do you do, what kind of concept do you like to have of it?
Well, on Nonpareil, we had the advantage of working together as a group for about a week before we did the album. Instead of going in the studio cold, it's much better this way, because when you get a piece of material and you work on it for a week in a club, things happen that wouldn't happen otherwise. You get more familiar, more relaxed, and certain things evolve.
How do you choose the material you want to play on it?
Oh, painstakingly. Yeah, I try to also go in the studio with a pretty good idea of everything I'm going to do. Leave not too much to chance, into just last-minute decisions.
How do you know when you've got the right take?
Well, that's difficult, because if I find that usually in the first two or three takes, you should have it, because after that, you start getting gets a little stale. But it's hard to keep your perspective when you've done it a few times. The best way is to keep it all and decide later.
Do you listen to much of your own work when you're not in the recording studio, and you don't have to listen to it back to make decisions?
No, I don't.
Does it make you uncomfortable to hear it?
Sometimes. I don't know. I think it, I like to study music, and I don't think I can learn very much by listening to my own music.
Is it more tempting to repeat yourself if you've heard it on a playback?
Not for me, I don't think. No.
Well, let's listen to another piece from the new album Nonpareil, which we were just discussing a little. We're going to hear This Is New. What made you decide to record that?
Well, I always loved this tune. It's by Kurt Weill, and I originally heard it Benny Goodman record in the 40s with an arrangement, beautiful arrangement by Eddie Sauter. And it's a very unusual kind of tune. And nobody had done it. And I'd been thinking about doing this tune for some time before we did it.
I've been noticing that some tunes go in and out of fashion also. Like, everybody's been doing Gershwin again recently.
Yeah.
Let's see. If You Could See Me Now seemed to have a little fashionable period for a couple of years after years of nobody doing it. I guess it you've got to try to avoid, in a way, being that in step with things so that you're not recording the same tune that everybody else is that year.
Well, everybody's looking for new material all the time. You can't just go recording the same things over and over again. You can play the same tune year after year in a club, but on recording, you've got to get new material.
Let's hear This Is New. From a pretty new album called Nonpareil, Al Cohn on tenor, Lulivi at the piano, Monty Budwig bass, and Jake Hanna on drums. This is new from Alcon's latest album, Nonpareil, and Alcon is my guest. Do you know people who swear that they can tell the difference between white players and black players?
Yes.
Does it make any sense to you to say that or to even consider it?
Oftentimes they're wrong. I suppose we all play who we are. So I suppose there is a certain way of telling, but there's a lot more crossover than there used to be. Maybe at one time it was more so. I don't think so much anymore.
See, in some ways everybody grows up listening to the same sources of music because everybody's got access to the same radios, though I guess everybody listens to different stations, maybe. But
yes, that's why you find good jazz players all over the world.
Listening to the radio and playing on the radio.
There are lots of Japanese players that are really fine and European players.
Is there much tension now between black and white players?
I don't see any, really.
Seems that jazz is maybe one of the few areas where there are black and white people playing the music and even, in a lot of instances, playing it together.
Yeah, so. Sports.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I don't know how the scene is among athletes is off the field, but musicians, I think there's mutual respect.
Your son is a guitarist?
Yes.
When did you feel like you had a vested interest in seeing to it that he became a musician?
No. No, I didn't want to force him into anything. I believe that if a young person has ambitions to be a musician, there's nothing you can do to stop him. And if he doesn't have those kind of leanings, then there's nothing you can do to get him going in it.
So
I left it up to him, and I think it worked out very well because the first thing that turned him on was Wes Montgomery, and that he was hooked after that.
Did you have experiences when you were young and learning how to play that you didn't want him to repeat?
No, not particularly. When he started playing, well, up until the time he started with music, he didn't show much interest in anything, really. So when he started in music, he became really obsessed by it. He's a practicer. He works. He's a worker. So there was nothing I could tell him. He was doing everything he was supposed to do. He used to practice 8 to 8, 10 hours a day. It still does.
Did you when you were
No.
No, you didn't have to?
No, I didn't practice as much as he did, but I was fairly diligent. But I didn't do that.
Did you ever have conflicts between deciding if you should be home practicing or out playing basketball?
No, not when I really became interested in music. When I was about 12.
So has living your life as a musician and arranger been anything like you thought it would be like when you first started to play and thought about becoming a musician?
Well, when I first started, the only thing I was hoping for was to be able to make a living at doing that, make a living at something I love to do. And so I've done that.
You certainly have. You've given a lot of us listeners a lot of pleasure in hearing your music, and I want to thank you for your records and for being here, for talking with us. Thank you,
Alcon. Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.